Hello there! This show contains material which a truly free society would neither fear nor suppress. The language and concepts contained herein will not cause eternal torment in the place where the guy with the horns and pointed stick conducts his business.
Yo, John. Yo, Lil J. What's going on?
I never thought you'd break that out.
Well, I've been waiting to break out the Lil J.
Lil J? What do I call you then?
You'll have to ask Dave to assign me a nickname.
Like, Dave, it works, because, you know, you can say, yo, Biggie D, D-Dog, D-Day. the letter D works. R isn't one of those letters that just rolls off the tongue.
Well,
it goes.
I think R does roll. That's the point.
Well, you have to force it, and it's not something that's in the hip hop scene.
Well,
Rico,
suave. You're Lil J, and he's Biggie D, right?
Yeah, that's right. We've got a thing.
Yeah. Well, I won't get between you two, so you can.
It's more like a Bloods and Crips kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. What are we drinking today?
People got hurt.
Let's just jump right into the wine.
What are we? I think we already did about an hour ago. This is Fred McMurray Ranch. No, it's McMurray Ranch, Central Coast, Pinot Noir, 2005.
You don't even like the Pinot Noirs.
I thought I'd give it a shot because it was highly rated. You know, people like the Pinots. I like it in pesto.
Yeah, can't beat that.
It's a California.
Cool. Coolio, Lil J.
I think it's pretty good. You said it was sweet.
Yeah, it is a little sweet. I think it's sweeter than the wine. What did we drink a couple of weeks ago or last week where you thought it was sweet and I didn't think it was so sweet?
But I think it was called F'd Up Malt Liquor.
Yeah. What about Long Leak Malt Liquor? That was another one of those.
Malt Duck.
So, you know, the Mets played San Francisco and won 2 out of 3, you know, a couple days ago. Barry Bonds, largely ineffective. He didn't actually play the first game. And I think I know why. I have a theory.
He's off the clear.
What does that mean?
He's off the cream.
Well, I don't know if he's still using the steroid gel or whatever it is that they use.
That's what they call it, the cream or the clear.
Well, here's my theory. Just like Superman had kryptonite, I think the Mets in their stadium, they have this thing called steroidinite.
Bonzenite?
No, it's steroidinite.
Steroidinite?
And the steroidinite waves, you know, mess with Barry Bonds, and they make it so he can't play that well. And you know what? They reach all the way to the Bronx, too, which is why Giambi really has been, you know, injured and not playing well this year also.
Giambi. Yeah.
Jason.
He's gone.
It's because of the steroidinite.
Yeah, bone spurs, they said.
It's because of the steroidinite.
I'm hearing this. It's like a rumor.
That's
Where did
my
I hear
theory.
This before?
It's my theory, steroidinite.
How do you explain David Wright's teeth then?
What does that mean?
I think there's extra fluoride in the water in the park there.
There might be. I don't know. But actually, one of the Mets was suspended. One of the ones in their mind.
Yeah,
sent me
I know
the
about
email,
that.
A guy named Perez. And actually, one of their pitchers just came off of a 50-game suspension, too.
Jorge Reyes, Jose
He's
Reyes.
A minor league player who was suspended for 100 games for some sort of sports-enhancing substance use. But then one of the pitchers who's actually on the big league club was using some banned substance and got a 50-game suspension, and he just came back from that. And I forget which guy it is. I'm having trouble remembering. But nonetheless, it's everywhere, and it's sort of irritating.
It reminded me of this YouTube clip that a colleague of mine sent me. I gotta put it on the website. It's great. It's like this documentary film about spiders, and it's done in like a National Geographic kind of mode, and it's great. And they talk about, you know, they give the spiders different substances, and they show how it changes their behavior.
Oh, yeah.
And then they show the crack spider, and then they show him popping a cap in another spider. It's great. And then the marijuana spider builds a hammock and sleeps all day.
Well, he builds a web, no?
Right, and he watches the caffeine spider spinning around. It's wonderful. You got to see it.
What about the LSD spider?
They show that one too, where he just built this crazy web, random strings everywhere.
What a crazy web you weave as you deceive.
Hey, we saw some tunes last night. We heard some tunes too.
That's right. What did who was that again?
There's some porn stars we saw.
Yeah.
Oh, actually, I think that they were high school gym teachers. Steely Dan.
Yep. John and I went to see Steely Dan at the Turning Stone Resort and Casino in scenic Oneida, New York. Turning-stone.com.
The thing that kept running through my head through the entire show was, oh, man, I feel old. I mean, the guys on stage, they must feel a lot older because they're like in their 60s. But man, I feel old because I was sitting there trying to get into the music and I was enjoying it for the most part. But I was thinking, man, it's getting late. I want to go home and sleep.
Well, you needed more food. You're just, your blood sugar was just low.
It dropped a little bit, but I had that piece of slab of whatever.
Of albino pizza.
Albino pizza.
It was the oddest looking thing I've ever seen. And I asked him, I said, John, was that any good? No, but it did the trick.
Yeah.
It was calories anyway.
At least I put hot pepper on it. Made it feel a little bit better.
So was cardboard.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, the casino is a trip for people watching, and they have this cool, they have two cool concert venues. They have one called the Event Center, which sits about, I don't know, 5 to 6,000 or 5,500.
It's like slightly smaller than like a hockey rink. It's really cool.
Yeah, and then they have another one called the Showroom, which is almost like a dinner theater with, it seats about 1,500, you'd think, right around there?
Yeah, I was actually trying to calculate because I was counting rows during one of the songs.
Is that one of your OCDs?
It's one of my OCDs. I like
Do you
to count.
Count tiles?
I don't count tiles.
Are you out on the tiles?
I definitely count. This is no joke. I count everything.
As I pour wine. How many wine glasses are there here, Ray?
Two.
You know, we were in a sales meeting once a couple of years ago, and a bunch of people, for whatever reason, wore black shirts, and it was winter. I had a black turtleneck on.
Were they fascists?
No, and there were no armbands involved, and my boss walked in, who's sort of a geeky guy, which some people are saying people who have those geekish tendencies might be slightly autistic and things like that. I've heard that more than once. But anyway, he walked into the room. He just stared at the table and went, black, black, black. I mean, he didn't even do it on purpose.
Black, black, black.
Yeah, it was like the Rain Man. 249 toothpicks. You know, I mean, it was really odd, and I found it very interesting, sort of reinforcing that idea that maybe the sort of brain chemistry, you know, that sort of makes one more geekish and into geekish hobbies may lend itself towards, you know, being on the autistic spectrum, you know?
Would you describe his driving skills as being excellent?
He is actually an excellent driver. No, I don't know, because I've been behind him, and it's almost like he's not moving. He's got this $50,000 Acura RL, and I can outrun him when he drives.
It's a nice car.
It's a great car.
But thinking, what are his thoughts on Kmart?
Depends on when you ask him, you know.
Is he a fan of the judicial daytime shows?
Wapner. Anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Steely Dan. Now, I went because I wanted to hear a slamming band, and I know that the guys in Steely Dan, the two main guys, always back themselves up with some really rocking players, and I was not disappointed. The guy next to me, you know, probably wanted to get in a conversation with me about Steely Dan. He's probably got all their records and has license plates with their names on them and everything.
As one guy did.
Yeah, as one guy actually did. But he said to me, so, you know, I don't even remember how he started the conversation. Are you a big Steely Dan fan? And I said, well, you know, I don't own any of their records. I just came to hear the band, you know, the backing band, because I know they're going to have some great players in it. And then he just got silent.
What you should have done is thrown your arms up in the air and said, ah, I did it again. Wrong show.
I thought this was Metallica. Right. I was at years ago when they re-released Star Wars, the original one in 83 or 84. They re-released it theatrically so you could go see it again. Me and my friends went to see it at the Cannonball Cinema in Clinton.
I remember the Cannonball.
Which is a great little cinema that's been turned into like an office building with three different offices in it. And I remember, you know, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, the theater is dead silent as John spills wine all over himself. John has a drinking problem. So anyway, you know, the blue letters come up. Suddenly he's Shields and Yarnell over here spilling wine on himself. There's a 70s reference. So anyway.
Spit takes don't work on a radio show.
Nor on expensive microphones. And so, yeah, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, the theater's dead silent. And I just say, this isn't Porgy's. And it got a laugh out of like most of the people in the theater.
Well, the guy next to me was slightly different than the guy next to you. And I would have swapped gladly.
Why? Did you interact with the guy next to you?
No.
I was the guy next to you.
And I have two sides. The guy next to me was trying to sing through every single song off key.
Oh, I did hear him singing. Yeah, well.
It's awful.
He was trying to sing off key, so he was actually on key?
No, he did a great impersonation of someone who couldn't sing.
Well, gotta get him on TV.
Oh, he was awful. Awful.
Well, yeah, so Steely Dan sounded really good. They did play Hey 19, but, you know, I'm not a big fan. I had a very traumatic experience as a teenager listening to that
Please
song.
Please don't recount it.
No, I'm not going
to. You told me about it, and I'm already, you know, off my lunch.
I'm not going to recount that story, but they played all the classics, and, yeah, great band, just slamming.
Well, the thing is, they've got so many songs that everyone's heard before, they could probably do four or five shows and not repeat a song, but... I was hoping for three or four songs that I didn't hear, and I was glad they didn't play one song, which was Reelin' in the Years.
Yeah, I could do without that one, too. I mean, it's sort of... I don't even know how to describe it. It's just... I just heard it way too many times, I guess. It's like Stairway, but not nearly as obnoxious.
Well, yeah, and I could probably sing the entire guitar solo from memory.
Most people could. I mean, it's been played
so often, yeah.
Yeah, I think Jeff Skunk Baxter played that guitar solo.
Did he?
The guy from the Doobie Brothers.
Wow.
Yeah. He stopped by our booth at a trade show once. He's a really cool guy. He's also doing, like, consulting to the Defense Department. Did you ever see? Look up Jeff Skunk Baxter or Jeff Baxter Pentagon or something. Plug that into Google. He consults to the Pentagon. It's quite odd. I don't know
really
why or how, but he's a pot-smoking musician hanging around the Pentagon. I don't know.
Dude, you need more locks on those doors.
Anyway, you want to jump into a tune?
Yes.
Actually, this one, we owe you one. We owe you a Wachowski tune, so we're going to play another one, and we'll tell you why in a minute, but I'll just start by saying it's all John's fault. Check it out.
Old school.
I like the Hammond organ.
Hammond.
The little spinning Hammond organ thing at the end there.
I thought you didn't eat meat.
Vibrato. What?
I thought you said you didn't eat meat. You just said you like ham and organs.
Well, you know. Guess who's playing keyboards on that track?
I don't have to guess.
Yeah, that was Mark Wachowski, and we owe you one because, you know, I thought we didn't play last week's tune, Games, I think it was.
Yeah.
But we played it, and ironically, we played it on the previous, last year's Memorial Day weekend.
That's the oddest thing in the world. We played it, and just coincidentally, we played it the 1 year later, exactly
almost
1 year
to
later.
The day, and I blame John because he's our music librarian, and he didn't check the website.
Music librarian?
Exactly.
When so was I bestowed that honor?
Well, just now. So I think we owed you a Wachowski, and yeah, that's another one off his record, which I have in front of me right here. It's called
Eponymous.
That's My Story.
Oh, that's right. It does
Wachowski.
Have a title.
It's That's My Story, and I'm sticking to it. And that one is called Baby Hold On. And yeah, I mixed it, and John's brother Frank played keyboards on it. It was another one he kind of phoned in, but you know.
And we played it, and there, the circle is complete.
That the circuit is now complete. So anyway, we're going to talk about films now, aren't we?
Tis we are.
So what film do you want to talk about anyway?
Children of Men. Something we both saw. It was homework.
It wasn't announced, but it...
It was. I think you even said if anyone wants to follow along, we're going to be watching Children of Men.
A couple weeks ago, did I say that?
I think it was even last week.
Was it Children of Men I was talking about?
I think it was.
Or you was said it Deep Throat?
No, that was just extracurricular.
That was just extra credit, you know.
That's right. You get bonus points. I got my star on the wall for that one.
Children of Men. Yeah, who directed that?
That was by Alfonso Cuarón.
I think he's a Spaniard, no?
He is, he's Latino.
Yeah, well, geez, whoa, thanks.
No, he's, I'm trying to look up here on IMDb what he is.
The IMDb.
Yeah.
One of the best websites in the
world.
He's
from Mexico.
Ah, he's Mexicano.
Yes, he's Mexican, and he's done a couple of other films. I think, let's see, Possibility of Hope is something that's being filmed. I think I've heard a couple of things about that. He did a Harry Potter film.
Potter's Imagine Harry, that. Did he?
He did one of the Harry Potter films, and he also did Y Tu Mama Tambien.
Y Tu Mama Tambien is a great movie. Have you seen that?
I have not, but I've heard a lot of good things about
it. Put that in your queue, and it's got Diego Luna, who is this sort of young, up-and-coming Hispanic star. He's very, very talented. But yeah, check that out. We can talk about that in the future. But anyway, we're not here to talk about that. We're here to talk about Children of Men.
Children of Men. I thought this was a very interesting film because it makes you think. It's not just a film where you watch Bruce Willis go through buildings and save people.
Yeah, and I mean, it's the kind of movie that, despite the fact that it's not that disturbing, I mean, it is
it's very disturbing.
Well, but it's not, you know, it's not hostile disturbing, you know what I mean?
Well, right, it's not a horror film.
Right, it's not that disturbing, but it makes you think, and it's the kind of film that, for me, keeps me up at night. You know, thoughts just keep pinging around in my brain, and I just don't sleep well because my brain can't let it go. It wants to think about it.
Mm-hmm. And I was actually trying to think about, you know, how do I characterize the film? And unfortunately, I have to rely on someone else's judgment and say, yeah, he got it exactly right. Did you watch the, I think you did say that you watched the extra portions, what are they called?
The
special features.
The bonus features, yeah.
Yeah, and there was some commentary, and there, I don't know if he was a writer or philosopher or whatever, whoever. He was talking about the film as being something like a hyper-real, where he describes it as a way of showing reality better than reality actually is, more accurate than reality is. And I think that's a good way of showing it, because even though things were exaggerated and it was a future film, it took place, I think, in 2027.
Yeah, yeah. But 20 years from now.
20 years from now. It shows a future where things have sort of collapsed. And it's not like a future where, like, Blade Runner, things flying around, you know,
well,
flying cars and all that.
Did you hear what the director said? He wanted it to be the anti-Blade Runner.
Right.
It's actually the very language he used.
Yeah. So it's not the future film where people are shooting laser beams at each other. It's a very realistic future, a plausible future, where you've got technology that is pretty much able to be done today, but it's more widespread. The society is in collapse because of other things we'll talk about in a minute. And very grimy and dirty. And
which Blade Runner was. Blade Runner was definitely very grimy and dirty, but it did have the Jetson cars and all
yeah,
that.
Yeah, didn't have the Jetson cars that made the... But yeah, it was and it also raises some questions about, you know, where we're going as a society and the things that we rely on, and if they're taken away from us, what happens? I thought it was very, very thought-provoking. I can't say that enough.
Well, for me, the film, what word do I want to even use? I mean, was it the cinematography? Was it the direction? I mean...
Absolutely.
There was... I know, but it's so much more than that at the same time. The fact that they can do a scene that's 15 minutes long in one take with no cuts, that to me, the word cinematography doesn't even begin to describe the...
That's cinematography and direction combined.
I know, but I mean, that's so huge, you know? The fact that they could do these 15-minute scenes... with you know, ridiculous amounts of action and stuff going on in the background and just nail it. Bam, you know?
Well, that's what adds to that realism, because if you're watching any film, if you're conscious of it, there's a cut every half second almost.
There can be. Yeah, absolutely.
In action sequences.
In green screen or blue screen or whichever vintage film you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. And even in old films, there are a lot of cuts. There's a conversation. There's a cut between each person in the conversation.
And they would have used matte paintings, not green screen.
That's true. And some of those were gorgeous. But we digress. but it's something we've gotten used to. It's become the language of film. And we almost think of films as being comfortable and natural if they have all these cuts. When you take those cuts away, you realize what real life is all about. Everything happens all at once in one steady flow. There isn't a beginning, there isn't an end. It's just one steady flow.
Right, yeah.
And I think the film was actually, from the beginning to the end, it was like that as well.
There was exactly two cuts in this film, right. If I'm not mistaken.
I think more than one time there were shots that didn't end after 15 minutes, and that's unheard of.
Yeah, one of the most absolutely ridiculously... Oh, I don't even know. I can't even find the right words, but there was a sort of a car chase sequence that started right. out with them kind of driving to a safe house in the woods of England. And, well, we're in a future where sort of England is the only country surviving, right?
Managing, muddling along.
Muddling along. All the other countries have either succumbed to some sort of nuclear holocaust or financial ruin or whatever. So everyone is sort of trying to flock to England. And they're fugitives, and they call them Fugees.
Refugees.
Yeah, and they're calling them Fugees.
And there was a band called the Fugees.
There was a band called the Fugees.
And that was from the word refugee.
Yeah, and they have a very active police force that's always trying to go out and find the Fugees and put them in jail. And
keep them at bay.
Yeah, the world that they live in there's another huge thing we haven't even mentioned, mm-hmm. and it's that for whatever reason, nuclear whatever... everyone is sterile, apparently, and no one can, they cannot produce offspring anymore. So basically, I don't even know what I want to say here. They're not reproducing. So basically, eventually, everyone is going to die. Right. So they're in a place where one of the reasons it's so grimy and, you know, bleak is because they're not keeping up with infrastructure. Because why would you need to? Because in 40 years, everyone's going to be dead.
That's right. Not only that, the tax base is shrinking because as people die off, there are fewer and fewer people supporting that infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also something that's not really mentioned, but I would think in a situation like that, there's got to be mass despair. Because
I would hope.
There's this huge reminder every single day that the world is not going on. The end of times are coming for humanity.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one of the movie starts by talking about the death of he who is the youngest person on the planet. You're apparently this incredible celebrity if you're young, you know,
right.
because
he's 18 years old.
Yeah. And he's the youngest person and he died in Venezuela or something.
Yeah.
His name was Diego something. And
someone murdered him.
Yeah, and it was tragic, you know. He was the baby of the world, he was the world's baby,
yeah.
you know, because he was the youngest person on the planet, and since they can't have any offspring anymore, to be the youngest person on the planet makes you celebrity.
They even call him Baby Diego.
That's, well, there you go.
Yeah, so it's, I don't know, it was, there are films, and you said it to me, there are films that after you watch them, you sort of can't sleep at night because you're thinking about them and your head's sort of spinning for a while. I didn't go to sleep until 2 in the morning after I saw that.
I mean, I went directly to bed because I watched it. It had to be returned, basically. So I needed to watch it, and I needed to watch it before Blockbuster was going to charge me $29 million because I didn't return it in 7 days or whatever their dumb rule is.
And not to digress again, but do you know they have a grace period?
They do, yeah. But I think I was...
You were already in the grace period?
I was on the edge of the grace period. And I was in that zone, you know, that comfort zone. And so I needed to watch it, and I ended up staying up till 12:30 or something, and that's late for me because I'm getting old. And
I
went to bed immediately, but nonetheless, and I fell asleep, but I dream about it. I have these like OCD stress dreams where my brain won't let it go. And I wake up and I wake up in a sweat and I'm like
screaming baby Diego.
Well, no, but I wake up in a sweat and I'm like, whew, man. What was that about? And then I try to go back to bed again, and I dream about it more, you know? And usually takes me about 24 hours for my brain to let it go.
Yeah.
But, I mean...
I still haven't let it go.
Well, I haven't either. I mean, I think about it. John and I were talking about it today. But again, I mean, this film had it all. I mean, it just... In terms of filmmaking, it was... I don't want to say revolutionary, but it was astonishing. In terms of a piece of filmmaking, it was absolutely astonishing. And I mean, we've kind of seen the story before, you know, the bleak future from 1984 to Blade Runner or whatever. So that's not necessarily the bleak future. Isn't necessarily
this is
a
one
new
that can
idea.
Actually happen.
It certainly could happen, but that combined with this just mind blowing filmmaking and you know, action scenes that are 15 minutes long without an edit. I mean, that's just ridiculous.
Yeah, and we haven't even talked about the actors who are in this, and I think
and
they deserve a
mention.
There's some
wonderful actors in there.
Clive Owen plays the lead, and he's the anti-hero kind of guy. Who's
right, yeah.
Someone who's already, you know, succumbed to despair, because as you learn through the film, he had a child, and the child died, and, you know, as a normal human being who lost a child, you know, I can only imagine the horror of that, and being surrounded by despair all day long.
Oh, the horror.
Yeah, he's somewhat of a drunk, and he's...
he hates his job.
He hates his job.
Like most people.
Yeah, and he's just trying to muddle through. And
yeah, he's getting through every day. He's faking it, you know.
Mm-hmm. And then you learn that he actually was involved with Julianne Moore? Is that her
Julianne
name?
Moore.
Julianne
yeah.
Moore.
Who...
She's like the one of the leaders of a revolutionary group.
Yeah, which he was involved with her.
Yeah, politically you know? Active at one time. And she was the mother of the child, so they were married at some point, you think.
Yeah, yeah.
And she comes back in their life, in his life.
Yeah, she propositions him, but not in the way that you would think.
Yeah, and I don't want to give away the crux of the story.
We're not going to give away the money shot.
That's right. You can see that later in Deep Throat.
Yeah, exactly.
And one of my favorite characters in the entire film.
One of the greatest actors of all time, as far as I'm concerned. I think if we're talking about...
Was it Roger Moore?
Sure.
What was it? Spencer Tracy? I can't
Lou
remember.
Lou Abbott?
Michael Caine.
Michael Caine.
Yeah, and then one of the things I was watching in this is, wow, Michael Caine is actually like in a movie that's good.
Well, come on, he's been in some good movies.
He's been in some phenomenal movies, but of late, not so much.
Well, no, and I think it's perhaps just because of his age, you know? Yeah. I mean, of all of the aging, wonderful British actors/actresses, I mean, Judi Dench is really the one who's consistently getting work. But, I mean, if I were casting a film, I mean, I'd cast Michael Caine as the child. I mean, he can act young. He's just so great.
Yeah, and the thing that I was thinking about just today was... If this was happening in 2027, and he was probably like in his late 50s, early 60s, supposedly in the movie, he's like our age.
Yeah, yeah, he would so be.
He would be
yeah.
like one of like. Will you be his
in the
age?
Year 2007? Yeah, he'd be our age. We'd be his age.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was another thing that sort of smacked me in the head. But yeah, he plays this hippie kind of guy who's a friend of the lead. I think Theo is his name.
Theo. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not to be confused with Huxtable.
Yeah, and I think that the whole ensemble, even the bad guys, you know, they had some serious characters there too.
Yeah, well, they were very memorable, no doubt about it. The cop, what was his name? The guy who helped them and then didn't help them.
Yeah, there was a cop who sort of helped them get out in the situation that they were in. Again, we're not sort of speaking about the situation which we will not speak of. His name was Sid, and he was a very
Sid, yeah.
strange character who spoke in the third person about Sid.
Yeah, I always like the
so
people.
So Sid
who,
saw you on TV.
I always like the people who speak about you know themselves in the third
he
person.
He was a sadist a little bit.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so I'm giving this every thumb that I've got.
This movie was phenomenal, and you know I can never remember this guy's name. I always have a memory block, a mental block against this name, but who directed Blade Runner?
Ridley Scott.
Ridley Scott, thank you. I'm going to write this down. I mean,
get a tattooed on your forearm.
I'm going to get it tattooed on my forehead or my foreskin.
That's not good.
No, wait a minute.
No, neither of those good.
No, because I don't have one of them anyway. I don't have a forehead. I got a foreskin. But
it was removed.
A Jewish guy came and he took my forehead.
It was a weird procedure. It only happens on Gentiles. But I'm bummed.
Ridley Scott, often credited as being one of the greatest directors of action sequences.
Did you see Black Hawk Down?
I actually didn't see that. I couldn't bring myself to see that.
But that's a rough movie to watch, but yeah. you have to respect the guy for his direction in that, too.
Well, no, absolutely. And when I saw it reviewed on Ebert and Roper at the movies, they absolutely were applauding the direction and, again, the action sequences. I mean, in whatever, Blade Runner, Alien, Gladiator.
Yep.
The guy knows how to direct a movie like that.
He's also got a very distinctive look. You can put every single one of Ridley Scott's movies in a row, and they've got an identifying look to them.
Right.
He has a style.
But where I'm going with this, and I said this to you in an email or in a conversation, was that, I mean, some of the action sequences in this film would probably make him a little jealous. I mean, just unbelievable.
I think they would make him proud, because I don't think that people like Cuarón here could have actually conceived of a film like
without Ridley Scott.
Yeah,
absolutely. This film is definitely, you know, I'm not sure if these action sequences could have happened. I mean, and technically they had to break some new ground. They, because they're doing all these ridiculously long action sequences without a cut, they had to develop all of these, you know, weird vehicles with motorized cameras in them, and they did. It was just, you got to watch the bonus footage on the CD to appreciate what they did, but it's ridiculous.
And something that, I don't know if you notice this or not, in that long sequence, in the long action sequence near the end of the film, mm-hmm. when he's going through the buildings,
mm-hmm.
before he got through the building, there were explosions, and there was some blood splatter right on the lens.
Yeah.
And they kept it on the lens.
Yeah.
And to me, I think that was genius, because it wasn't like they were saying, oh, man, we did this long shot, we can't do the whole thing again, or we can't erase that. They could have absolutely used digital effects to erase those blood spots.
Or maybe the effects were digital effects.
I don't think so, but I think they left them there because it's almost like documentary footage.
Yeah, this film
makes you feel real.
Yeah, this film was a narrative, but yet it was filmed like a documentary. It was wild.
Yeah, and it's not like a documentary like the Blair Witch Project either.
No. I actually haven't seen that. I'm not a fan of that genre, so I didn't see that.
No, it was filmed in such a way where you forgot that you were watching a movie. That's all. That's all I could say about it.
Yeah. So we're giving this all kinds of appendages raised to the heavens.
Yep, I'm going
to
take my thongs off.
You have more than one on? Thongs?
No, the ones on your feet.
No.
Actually, they're not. They're just sandals.
And, well, he's not wearing pants, so I can clearly see he's got a thong on. It's like, you know, you belong in...
Nice!
You belong in Frankie Goes to Hollywood or something. I don't know.
Hey, Frankie, save your legs. Okay?
Anyway, so, you know, check this film out. Phenomenal. You want to do another tune?
Dig it.
Let's check it out. Thank you.
is good.
Das good.
Is yes.
That was the amazing Lev Zherbin playing a cool song.
Songs like that make me want to like throw my hands up in the air and like sit on a chair and have people carry me around and break glasses.
What do they call those? Sedan chairs.
Is that what they call them?
Yeah, it's a sedan chair. His music is like a good pâté. It's just full of flavor.
Sorry. Can't relate. Does not compute.
I haven't had a pâté in many years.
I haven't had a pâté ever.
That was Lev Zherbin, and this guy's amazing because he actually arranges for Yo-Yo Ma sometimes.
Does
he? Yeah, his arrangements, and I believe he's performed at Lincoln Center with Yo-Yo Ma and Yo-Yo Ma's Silk Road Project.
Yo-Yo Ma!
This guy, thank you. This guy is just a world-class musician, an amazing composer, and his dad, whose name is Zherbin also, but I don't remember his first name, his father is one of the foremost composers slash film composers from Russia of all time.
He's get
written.
Out.
He's written scores for like 30 different films.
No, no, get out, leave.
No, I'm not going anywhere, man. Not without my gear. See you later.
You can pack up your gear,
and I will.
But that's enough. Eventually. You're just spewing nonsense.
But yeah, and it was so weird the way I met these people because you found that song by what was
Ramashka.
The band Ramashka, and then I just emailed them and had this little back and forth about Ramashka's music, and the woman, Inna, said, well, here, my fiancé's music is cool. Here's the password to his website. There's four or five songs available for download
for
the press. Here's
his credit card and everything.
Yeah,
Social Security
gave me his
number.
Mercedes-Benz. And I just sort of got to know her a little bit in email, and she gave us access to more of her fiancé's music, and then she told me about her future father-in-law, the foremost composer in Russia. It's an amazingly small world. How do you fall into these things? And that music is just absolutely gorgeous.
I'm trying to think of a way to make money off of this. It's not coming to me.
Well, he'll make money off of this.
Yeah, hopefully he will.
He deserves to.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I saw a really wild film at the Mussolini's Proctor Arts Institute.
Deep Throat?
No, it was called The Throat. No, the Wind.
The Throat That Shakes Your Barley? What?
It was called The Wind That Shakes the Barley. And what an interesting period piece this was. It takes place in 1920s Ireland, kind of around the time of the birth of the IRA. And we all sort of know the IRA as...
I can't stand them. They keep taking money from me every
year. I know.
Year.
Bastards. And we also... IRS, that's right. We sort of know the IRA through our media, right? They're the people who always set off bombs, you know, near the Prime Minister of Britain's house or whatever,
that's
you know?
Right.
And this movie just kind of reinforces something which I'll mention later. But what happens in this film is really wild. It starts in the 1920s, around the time when the Black and Tans, you're familiar with the Black and Tans?
Mm-hmm.
They were the thugs of the British Imperial
Army. Oh, I thought you were talking
about the beer. No, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But the Black and Tans were sort of the thugs of the British Army. And it was their job to sort of humiliate and intimidate the Irish people, the working class farmers and stuff, and sort of, you know, enforce Britain's dominance as imperialist leader, you know, imperialist country that they were. And that, of course, just made people want to become revolutionaries and fight the Brits. And that's sort of how the birth of the IRA happened. And this film, for me, it just kind of reinforces this idea that one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, within reason.
Well, certainly. I mean, you're not going to get any support from the world if you're blowing up bombs and killing innocent children. But I mean, 225 years ago, I'm sure the British Empire was calling the Patriots of New England terrorists as well, you know?
Well, yeah, and I think that really the distinction is the cause. What's the cause? If the cause is you want to impose your will upon other people, then, you know, I don't think that you can call them freedom fighters or revolutionaries. But if someone's being oppressed and they're fighting back, then absolutely, they're freedom fighters, revolutionaries. They're not terrorists. They're doing whatever they can, you know, by any means necessary, so to speak.
Yeah, but back home in England, they were probably being referred to as terrorists. I don't know if that word even existed then or it was in vogue in the 20s. But nonetheless, that's what's going on in this film. But the film goes on to a point around 1922 when a truce was declared between the IRA and the English masters. And they had this amazing choice to make. Can they accept partial independence from Britain? Will they continue to fight, you know, perhaps even hopelessly for complete independence? And what ended up happening was, around the time of that truce, you know, half of the IRA, if you will, kind of got in line and signed the truce and said, yeah, we're fine. And the other people wanted to continue to fight. And that's kind of, that's probably the people in the IRA who remain today. Weren't sanguine with that truce. You know, and one person in the film kind of put it like this. Our oppressors now no longer have British accents. They have Irish accents, you know? And I mean, I can sort of relate to that too. I can appreciate that.
We've seen the enemy and they are us.
Yeah, exactly. We don't have complete freedom, but we've kind of given into this treaty, this truce, this constitution, whatever you want to call it, to perhaps avoid some more bloodshed. But we really don't have complete freedom, and we've lost Northern Ireland to the Brits. So, you know, again, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter, you know? And I mean, this sort of, a really interesting exclamation point on this is that, and you probably are aware of this because you're a bit of a Beatles fan, but I believe it was in the 70s that Paul McCartney wrote a song called Give Ireland Back to the Irish. Are you familiar
with
that?
Absolutely not. And I don't know.
It was banned. The BBC was not allowed to, oh my God, you know, God forbid somebody, you know, voice their opinion, give Ireland back to the Irish, and the song is banned, you know? So, I mean, clearly, it's still a pretty hot topic, you know? But this is an interesting film because it lets us have a look at the roots and the cause, kind of the IRA. And, you know, it's definitely shown from a bit of an Irish perspective, but at the same time, the black and tans were just brutal and vicious. And you know what? If I were Irish and these thugs walked into my farm area and started abusing my sister or, you know, wanted to burn my house down, I would have been one of the first guys to pull out an axe and take a hack at these guys or a gun and take a shot at these guys, you know?
Well, yeah, they're protecting their homes, they're protecting their lifestyle, they're protecting, you know, their families.
Absolutely.
And I think that, unfortunately, in those situations, even if
you're right,
even if the British, well, not I'm not talking about the Irish here, but even if the British felt that they were doing the right thing, you know, they've got power and they're wielding power. And I'm sure there were abuses of power and, you know, treating people inhumanely.
But you were talking about the beer, the Black and Tan. Our local brewery came out with their version of Black and Tan, and traditionally a Black and Tan has been a stout mixed with a lager or something.
Sort
of
like that layered thing.
Yeah, kind of a half and half. So we have a local brewery here called the FX Matt Brewing Company, and they came out with a premium line of sort of microbrew kind of beers called Saranac.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Saranac line, they have a beer called Black and Tan. And when that beer came out, I remember an editorial in our local newspaper saying, how could you call a beer a Black and Tan? I mean, these guys were thugs. They were murderers. They were rapists. But unfortunately, the term Black and Tan had been used for a beer before Utica Club decided to come out with this beer. But at the same time, you can appreciate, you know, okay, let's call a beer an SS officer, you know? I mean, these guys were thugs. They were bastards, you know?
Well, but there's an Irish pub that I used to go to all the time. It was probably 2 blocks away from where I used to work downtown Syracuse, called Kitty Hoynes. And
was, by the way, where the Wright brothers flew their airplane, was it not?
No.
No, okay.
That was Kitty Carlisle. Anyways, Kitty Hoynes, it's a real Irish bar. The bartender is Irish. The owner is Irish. We're not talking like just Irish American from Ireland, Irish accents and everything. And they serve up black and tans. And a black and tan is they would put half of Guinness and half of some lager.
Or a Bass Ale, maybe.
Or actually, it was Bass Ale. You're right.
Yeah, the local Irish bar, what is it, over by the YWCA? Well, Kelly O'Neill's. Yeah, they used to do half Bass Ale and half Guinness. And it's a wonderful drink, even though I can't have it anymore because of the
wheat thing.
The barley. The
wind shaking it.
Yeah, it was the barley in the wind. But you can at the same time appreciate where somebody might be sensitive to the use of the phrase black and tan because these guys were thugs. Thuggery, again, in keeping with last week's show. But anyway, this was a really amazing piece of work directed by Ken Loach, and he's actually gotten a lot of criticism in England. Imagine that. From making this film. It's an Irish film from Ireland, 2007. As of the time I saw it, it was not rated. 127 minutes. So
it's
I think
triple
this
X
one
now, isn't it?
It might be. You never know. It might be next to Deep Throat on the shelf, but it's definitely worth seeing. So definitely check it out.
Hey, guess what?
What? That's a show. So anyway, check us out on the web, www.bloodyveg.com.
Hit our forum. It's the aforementioned bloodythumpsomething.com/forum.
Yeah, it's bloodyveg.com/forum. You can send John feedback for being an awful music librarian to feedback@bloodyveg.com.
Hey, look, I went to music librarian school and I failed. So I went to my real true calling.
That's right. And the, our whole
forestry.
Our whole Dewey Decimal system is totally messed up on our website anyway.
I looked up the wrong Dewey for some reason.
That's right. Yeah. Professor Bunsen Honeydewey. And Beaker. Me, 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 me. Anyway, we hope you had a good time. Remember, you've been listening to the VIB.